And now, your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Dean Haglund, welcome back to Los Angeles.
Oh my God, it's great to be back.
Is it?
It is, actually. Shockingly, there's much that I've missed. Not weather aside, it is the weird eclecticness of beatbox music coming out of cars versus hilarious, I think I heard Johnny Cash, Folsom Prison Blues playing from the subway. And I think, I'm not sure, but I believe a band was practicing in the parking lot behind my building, out in the street. So it's a glorious mix of culture and music and festive love in the City of Angels.
That's not true of Detroit?
Well, no, Detroit has music, but it seems to be indoors because it is, you know, 29 degrees, a mix of snow and rain. It's really hard to get your dance groove on when it's icy and snowy and you have a warning.
Not for me. Not for this kid.
That's when you dance the best, really, when it's icy and snowy.
All our joviality, of course, takes place in the shadow of the sad departure of the 41st president of the United States, George Herbert Walker Bush.
Right.
And, you know, I turned 50 last week.
Happy birthday, by the way.
And
Oh my God.
Hopefully, Levelator can take care of all that distortion.
I bust a mic for your happy birthday.
Oh my God. You do realize we have the shotgun mic there for you. I mean, you could go next door and we'd be picking you up.
Yell happy birthday from the neighbor's place.
And feel free, by the way.
Okay. Happy birthday.
Even if I hadn't turned 50, I would know that I have become older, let's say, by virtue of the fact that before he died, I actually found myself in recent months pining wistfully for the days of George H.W. Bush as president.
Really?
And then finding myself riveted by the coverage that night. I mean, right? Staying up till the middle of the night after the news broke, watching documentaries that had already been put together
about him.
Yeah,
they knew.
Especially in the wake of Barbara Bush's death.
Yeah, they're very close. You know, you have to cut one together.
So it's been fascinating. Certainly it's been fascinating, you know, because this is sort of the first, I guess, Reagan, obviously.
Right.
But, you know, I was an adult. My first presidential election that I voted in was in 92, when Bush ran against Clinton.
Clinton, right? Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And so George H.W. Bush is the president that I come of age to.
Get it, yeah.
And so I like to think at that point in my life, exercising my agency as a citizen to vote, that I was very aware of what was going
on. Up on the issues.
And so here we are, you know, the 28, 30 years later, and to see those times replayed, maybe there was a thing or two I wish I'd known.
That was kept secret from you at the time?
No, not really. I mean, like, I texted this to my friend Peter Murdoch in the middle of the night. I said, you know, in 92, I neither voted for Bush nor Clinton.
Oh.
I voted for Perot.
Oh, you did? Ross Perot.
The Bernie slash Trump of his era.
Totally.
Because think about it. He was totally anti-NAFTA.
Totally.
A lot of the rhetoric was the same. And, of course, a Bush, let's not forget, was primaried. Never goes well for a sitting president when they get a real primary challenge. Jimmy Carter in 1980 gets primaried by Ted Kennedy and then goes on to lose quite handily to Reagan.
Yeah.
You know, it's tough for a sitting president to withstand a primary season of attacks in party and then to galvanize the base, hold the party together, and then withstand another brutal round of attacks. In 92? In 92, he was primaried by Patrick Buchanan.
Oh, Buchanan.
Who ran largely on a platform of let's build a wall along the southern border.
That's right.
Right? So anyway, so the point is that I text my friend Peter Murnick in the middle of the night, and I realized, I said, you know, I didn't vote for Bush. I didn't vote for Clinton. I voted for Perot. Where we're at is my fault in no small way.
There is a kind of a straight line from you to Trump, I hate to say.
And it is fascinating because, you know, people have been wondering where the utter divisiveness of our political discourse finds its origins. And a lot of time it goes back to
Reagan.
I think more often people say that it's a product of the 90s. They don't say Reagan because the truth is, like, Reagan and Tip O'Neill was the Democratic Speaker of the House, and they were great friends.
Yes.
So they often go to 90s. They go to the Clinton era, Tip O'Neill as Speaker of the House, though again, they actually managed to get things done.
Right.
Somehow Clinton loses the House and becomes a more effective president, which is interesting. But what I was realizing in watching some of these documentaries was about how George H.W. Bush had to make some deals with some emerging aspects of his own party.
Right.
Evangelical movement.
Right.
Right to Life wing of the party, which had never been a huge thing until the 80s. And, of course, he was a person who personally believed in the right to choice as established by the Constitution.
Yep.
And there were others. Like, he, of course, had to make that vow, no new taxes, in order to get elected in 88, because the real hawkish small government, what we would later call the Tea Party movement, backed by the Koch brothers, in the 80s had emerged as a major force. He had to make deals with them.
He
went back on that promise because it was the right thing to do for Americans.
Exactly. He couldn't hold that up, really.
So it's fascinating. And then you remember the 92 election. Clinton wins handily.
Yeah.
But with only 43% of the vote. I mean, it's a plurality. Right. It's not even a majority because Ross Perot gets 17% of the vote across the country.
Yeah, it splits the difference.
And much of that was conservatives who had split off.
Which is you.
I don't think I was conservative who'd split off necessarily, but let's face it, there were those Bernie bros in 2016 who end up voting for Trump.
Yep.
And you think, how can they go from a Democratic Socialist to... But what they were behind was the...
The
disruptive populism that seemed to capture the anger.
Well, and this is the thing. I'm all for disruption. I am, you know, an advocate in Silicon Valley of a disrupting business model.
Now Silicon Valley is left really holding the bag of blame for a lot of where we're at right now.
Absolutely.
Because they were all about disruption, but what happens when the disruptor gets all the power?
Right. This is the thing. You know,
they're every bit as bad, if not worse.
Because they have no legacy of power handling.
Well, yeah, no experience with it. But also, you know, there was something that Bush... President Bush 41 said apparently to Newt Gingrich when he took over the party in Congress. He calls him and a couple of the other really right-wing members of the House caucus into the Oval Office, and he says to them, "I am worried because of your idealism, you may let that idealism get in the way of good governance."
Right.
And what I love about that story is it shows what a kind of a remarkable man George H.W. Bush was, and how he achieves the level of power he does without ever having won any even statewide election until he's running for president in 88.
Right.
And it's because, what an interesting choice of words he found in one-on-one conversation.
Right.
He doesn't say, because of your ideology.
Says your
idealism. He uses a word that is something to admire.
Right.
And at the same time issues the cautionary tone of, sometimes we have to let good governance be the ideal that we're representing rather than our own personal idealism.
Right. However, he was the head of the CIA before that, and his connections to Noriega and all of
Well, he was head of the CIA for 1 year.
Well, you know,
remember, he
didn't come from nowhere to be the head of the CIA and then not.
Well, he had 9 different jobs from the late 60s through 1980. 9 different jobs. He went from being a congressman to UN ambassador to being ambassador to China for a year,
right.
Then brought back by Ford to head the CIA because the Republican Party needed people to basically restore faith in these institutions after Watergate
Nixon. Yeah, right.
And George H.W. Bush, the youngest naval fighter pilot in the history of the United States of America, enlisted the day he turned 18.
Right.
He was the man of the kind of record and credit. You know, he was the chair of the national... how about getting this job? He's named by Nixon as the RNC chair after the re-election.
Ah.
So congratulations, you are now the RNC chair after the Watergate break-in. You're Johnny on the spot while the investigation's going on.
Good luck on that.
Yeah, he was really fun. I mean, the interviews that he would give talking about it are amazing. He would say, yeah, this is a terrible job. It is no fun. But you know what? The loser is not me. The loser is not the Republican Party. The loser is the system in all of this. He was always very worried about institutions. And indeed, let's not forget, he was very worried about the very neocons who would end up taking control in his son's administration.
Right.
The Donald Rumsfelds of the world, for example. In fact, he was completely opposed to the invasion of Iraq.
Oh, was he? I thought he would be so...
No, he never thought he didn't go far enough. He did the mission in the original Iraq War, which was to free Kuwait.
Right.
It was not regime change. That's not what he was interested in. This is a man who presided over the end of the Cold War.
Right.
Right. He understood how containment works and can work. And then the importance, and you wonder, he lost re-election because of what was going on domestically in terms of the economy.
Yeah.
And people decided, you know what, there is no enemy anymore. There is no Cold War, everything's safe out there. But as we know, the peace can often be as dangerous as the threat of war.
Right. We had the Oslo Peace Accord, the wall came down, all of these things, which were the baseline to where we are now.
And suddenly the rise of terrorism.
Rise of terrorism, all of that.
So it's really interesting. And then when you are in the game of regime change, it's fascinating that he dies the same month that this new movie from Adam McKay, which I saw tonight, Vice, about Dick Cheney.
Oh, really?
Because, you know, here's someone, one of these neocons, who, like Karl Rove, was never actually ideological. He first came... He had been shamed into wanting to make something of himself and realized that becoming powerful would be to make something of yourself.
Right.
But he first was an intern, and he heard Donald Rumsfeld speak. And when he asked whether was asked whether he wanted to be an intern for a Democrat or a Republican, he had to ask, well, what party is that guy? Because he really liked what Rumsfeld had to say.
Right.
And he was told, Rumsfeld is a representative. He's a Republican. And Cheney said, good, that's what I am.
That's what I am. He figured that out based on
Liking that guy, the charisma of Rumsfeld.
Charisma, yeah.
And became someone who was very good at assembling power. Mm. And Bush, the elder George Bush, mm-hmm. a similar resume in some ways, you know, going from job to job, like what you're describing, and being able to focus power. But someone who was really an institutionalist, he believed in, like he said about being the head of the CIA, he loved that job more than any other because he loved going to a job to try to repair the reputation at a time when everyone in America distrusted that institution.
Ah, interesting.
And that's what he loved.
That's
because
what he loved.
Knew that it mattered. And indeed, by the time his son is president and the Iraq war happens, what's going on in his son's administration? They're ignoring all the intelligence coming out of the CIA.
Yeah.
And they're going along with entirely what's coming out of the Pentagon.
And how about building a narrative, unlike Colin Powell and all that, a fictitious narrative against what the intelligence...
Using Colin Powell, using him, because he was the figure with the most popularity in the administration.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
And despite all of his... He said no, he would not do it because the intelligence was wrong, and it wasn't until President Bush, his commander-in-chief, because Colin Powell was still a good soldier,
right.
ordered him to go and make that speech at the UN, and then suddenly 70% of America is behind it.
Yeah.
But it is fascinating, and there's so many differences, and it is an important film to have come out now when so many of these people are back in the administration. You've
right.
got John Bolton back in the administration. And you seem to have all of this transactional foreign policy again.
Yes.
Halliburton.
Yeah, right.
The it's Halliburton funny. War that Iraq was. And so it's an important film. It's a fun film.
It's fun.
Funny.
How can it be funny? How can it be fun?
How could it not be from Adam McKay and Will Ferrell?
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Adam McKay wrote and directed it.
I thought this was a documentary kind of thing.
Well, much like The Big Short,
yeah,
which was Adam McKay's previous film, his first foray into issue movies after doing the likes of Anchorman,
mm-hmm.
Like that, it is quasi-documentary at times, but also a narrative. Unlike that film, which was Oscar-nominated, this is character-driven. That had great performances from some of its stars, but this is truly character-driven, and it's truly Shakespearean, the relationship between Dick Cheney and his wife, Lynn Cheney, played by Amy Adams, and Christian Bale, who I think automatically is going to win the Oscar for this.
Wow.
And it's kind of about time, really.
I think it is, yeah. So compare this to Steve Buscemi and that Soviet...
Death of Stalin. Death of Stalin is very much a comedy, and it's very much the comedy of looking back. And this is much more the... It's Michael Moore meets something like Death of Stalin.
Oh.
Right?
Yeah.
Or Michael Moore meets Oliver Stone meets Armando Iannucci. It's kind of...
Yeah.
Because it's always a three-pronged approach now in Adam McKay's stuff. And what better... By the way, we're here in Los Feliz.
Yeah.
And we are literally recording in the building where Adam McKay was headquartered while he was making Anchorman.
So I did not know that.
We're just a couple floors up.
He was downstairs on the main floor?
The main floor there.
Good luck,
when you come
early
in,
yet.
Yeah. So, very appropriate.
But wait, hey, Adam, good job.
He's not there now.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
I was yelling
and neither
down.
Are our listeners after how distorted that.
I was yelling down to the first floor.
So, anyway, okay. it is. When I say it's fun, the movie is fun. The storytelling is fun, and it's irreverent, and it's funny.
Paced
and it's
properly.
Always played. You remember how you explained to me that even the scenes that aren't funny, which are most of them in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, are cut like comedy scenes.
Yes, right?
Right?
Yeah.
So here, what's so great is, yeah, there are some actual jokes that hit hard, that right. are really funny.
Laugh, gut busters.
Then there are scenes that, because they're cut comedically, are so depressing.
Right.
Because the joke's on us.
Yeah.
And wow. So it's a very interesting approach, and I think he's perfected the approach. Because I thought Big Short was a good-ish film, an important film. I thought it did a nice job of explaining its issues. But any time a movie is more about the themes it's exploring than the people who inhabit that world,
yeah, right.
There's only so far that movie goes towards earning your ultimate affection.
Yeah, for sure. Because you had to balance between the telling the complex story of financial complexities
yeah.
of the collapse versus the weird idiosyncrasies of the people.
Yeah, that how somehow, did these people, what yeah, drove them?
What drove yeah. them? And so you can't go that much into character development because you had to lay all this pipe to explain what the hell they yeah. knew and what financial system mechanicals were going on and, during that time.
And that's still a challenge, by the way, of a documentary, because I've heard some people say, well, that's why you need documentaries. But I still think it's the challenge of a documentary. It still needs to be more about the people who populate the world
absolutely
than the information of what went on.
Yeah, because otherwise then you have those YouTube videos where it's all little drawings yeah. of, you know, on a whiteboard where the little animation things go
on. It's so. Why to this day that documentary Enron, the smartest guys in the room.
Yeah.
Which is the full name of it.
Yeah, right.
It's not called Enron.
Right.
It's called the Smartest Guys in the Room. It's a movie about the smartest guys, the guys who think they're the smartest guys.
And destroy.
And so no matter when I turn on the TV, if that's on, no matter what part of the documentary it is, I find myself immediately riveted.
Right, because you're I'm on drawn, the characters.
Yeah, the yeah. characters of it. And it does, oh, by the way, a really brilliant job of explaining to me what happened and how it happened. You know, because I was just one of those people living in California wondering, why don't we have power in our grid all of a sudden?
Why am I staying on the spot market?
Why is Gray Davis being called the worst governor ever
right.
only a year after we reelected him to huge
numbers. Yeah.
numbers? And, oh, it's because the smartest guys in the room were using us as an ATM machine.
Totally. Anyway,
so
good story.
Vice comes out on Christmas, and like I said, I think Christian Bale wins Best Actor for it, and I must say, brilliant casting. Brilliant in that I think a lot of people might have said, are you sure? Steve Carell as Donald Rumsfeld.
What?
You know, when you first okay. see him, you go, okay, I get it. As a young Donald Rumsfeld, it kind of makes sense.
The big aviator yeah. ribs and all that.
And as a congressman and having no ideology and just being so craven and opportunistic.
And he gets the kind of voice down.
And laughing all the time.
Squinting,
maniacally.
Squinting.
So it's... so. But then when he becomes old Secretary of Defense in the 2000s, Don Rumsfeld, the work that the makeup artists do is so... he looks just like him.
Wow.
And because you've believed Steve Carell's performance, I mean, it's again, it's nomination worthy.
Wow.
Steve Carell as Donald Rumsfeld.
Wow. So. I can't... that, to me, is a casting coup
yeah.
that I cannot picture in my head. And yet, I can see Steve Carell carrying that off.
And obviously, their partnership... I mean, Steve Carell, let's not forget, was in The Big Short, had mm-hmm. one of the major roles in that. And, of course, Anchorman.
Anchorman goes so, from Baybeck, yeah.
There so, you go.
Fantastic.
Somehow, we went from George H.W. Bush to
Vice. I don't think that's that big a jump, really.
Yeah.
Yeah, no. Okay, so...
But I will say that I want to end our George H.W. Bush thing on this, though. Andrea Mitchell, the wonderful you know, political reporter, longtime White House correspondent,
yep.
She you know, she was interviewing Donald Trump when Trump admitted why he has attacks the media. Remember the why he declares them the enemy of the people in the
right.
world. And it he says to her in the interview, it's so that, you know, if I get caught doing something, people won't believe you.
Right.
And you know, and he says this to her, and it somehow in the aftermath of that, she was asked about her experience of having interviewed and known so many presidents, and she just kind of volunteers. This is months ago.
Uh-huh.
She volunteers how it was such a pleasure to cover George H.W. Bush because he was a true gentleman.
Ah.
That whether you think he was a great man or not, he was always a good man.
Ah.
And
manners count.
You know, and that's really interesting. And especially for someone like him, because how else does he become president? As he said, he had no political base anywhere in the country.
Right.
You always hear about, you got to get the base to turn out. He never had a political base.
Right.
As he said, he only had hundreds and hundreds of thousands of friends. Because everybody who met him thought that they were friends.
Right.
With him, and they probably were.
Right.
They probably were. And the other thing that I love is he reinstitutes a tradition that had died out for many decades.
Breakfast Club?
No, that has never died out. But leaving a letter for your successor.
Oh, yeah, right.
And to think that he's the one that reinstates
it. I can't believe that.
After losing to the man that he's writing the letter to. And that letter, it's beautiful. It's beautiful.
I thought Reagan would have wrote something.
To him.
Yeah, but that would have been lovely.
But no, but isn't it kind of more amazing? And again, that's the kind of thing I feel like we have lost.
Well,
can you imagine... In, let's just say hypothetically, that a Democrat wins the White House in 2020. Can you imagine the current occupant of the White House, who will be Mike Pence at that time? All right, that's where I was going with that.
That was awesome.
Was just the joke.
Fantastic.
As they,
you know where else they do that tradition? At the University of... in Pasadena, MIT?
Massachusetts. Caltech.
And so Einstein wrote a letter to the next incoming mathematician head, and so on and so forth. And there's a lineage of a letter from Einstein to the letter to all of the great physicists and mathematicians in a single desk. How cool is that?
So we have some serious news to catch people up on, to follow up on.
Good Lord, school closing? What, a blizzard? Oh, what are we talking about?
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God. Tom, we're breaking news.
Let me know when you're going to be leaning into that microphone.
I know. I suddenly got into real news. I'll lean back.
First of all, our movie, The Lady Killer, is available on DVD and on demand.
Yep.
Go to our website, theladykillersmovie.com. Find out why on the same day I could get... an email from a viewer complaining about how the film didn't show enough sex and violence, so it wasn't exploitive enough. And at the very same day, having the film derided as being from the demented mind of a millennial. So apparently I'm a millennial.
Well, congratulations. Yeah, that 50th birthday is really rolling back on you.
I'm getting younger. How can I be both those things? So maybe the truth is somewhere in between, and we hope that you will check it out, theladykillersmovie.com. There is a screening going to be coming up in Michigan, in your neck of the woods.
Yes,
I understand.
Once I can coordinate everything.
Yeah, so we'll we'll keep people in touch. And again, this conversation, we find the film... being released, you know, as where it seems, as Matt Giles said, to be so culturally relevant.
Yep.
And with each passing day, all the more so. Welcome to Time's Up and Me Too, Neil deGrasse Tyson.
How did that happen? That's a shocker, isn't it?
Is it, though? Is it?
Mm-hmm.
This is what I want to ask you. When you heard that news, were you shocked?
That's the thing about power, isn't it?
Isn't it?
Yes. Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And once you are in a powerful position, somehow all things go out your window.
Yeah, I can't even claim to be disappointed, let alone surprised, because I'm so not surprised that I can't even afford... all I can say is, great, exactly what we need. Just another reason for people to ignore science. Thanks, Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Well, and this is now the thing. When you get into a position of power, you have to step even more gingerly than ever before. or gingerly like horned.
And of course, he's a big star on the Nat Geo network,
yeah,
which is now owned by Fox. And I'm shocked that there would be sexual impropriety going on at a Fox-owned network. It's almost like the moment they bought it, it was in his new contract that he had to do it.
Now, these are older claims, of course, but it is... I don't know. What does one do and say at a time?
No,
like
if
this?
Anything, if these are older claims, as you're saying, then if anything, the purchase of Nat Geo by Fox probably helps those claims come to the surface.
Right.
Because they
are super sensitive.
Absolutely.
And they are now fighting misogyny wherever
hope,
they can.
You hope. Or at least.
I do hope. They're
or at least.
Systematically.
At least they're fighting. Future lawsuits.
Right. You because know. We know that they can't afford to have
right.
this thing.
It sometimes is in your financial interest to do the right thing.
Yes.
Which is how we say that things will really change when everybody realizes it's in their financial interest to do so. We can have a really effective economy based on renewables.
Renewables.
Okay.
And equality and...
Once we squeeze every drop out of exploitation, every dollar we can, then we will take you up on this offer of making money off the right thing.
Well, and 100% of your workforce that is equally paid and equally working. How about that? Why not instead of 51-49?
So you are back and we have actually clean air.
Yes, this is lovely.
Yeah, it is
a nice
lovely.
Breeze.
You did not experience any of the fires.
No, but I did talk to my friend who works for the fire service. He worked 16 days, 24-hour shifts with 5.5 hours off, where they were giving him a lousy hotel, so he chose instead to sleep in the ashes of the fire that he put out for 5 hours, then get up again and run another 24-hour shift. Did that 16 days in a row. This was just before the fire started. The Forest Service had laid off a bunch of their temporary workers.
Wow.
And just 2 to 3 days before both those fires started, and had to scramble to turn around to get everybody back. That also made for some compelling stories.
So the two things we need to follow up on. One, I mentioned Paramount Ranch,
mm-hmm.
which I love. It is official. It is going to be rebuilt.
Hooray!
With modifications.
Oh.
Changes, obviously. Hopefully,
better throw services. So.
Well, maybe also the construction can be done in such a way that it's more flame resistant.
Right.
You would think,
oh, yeah, right.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's one thing. Secondly, our friends Lee and Carla McCloskey,
yes.
Olandar was saved through their efforts. Was saved. They're fine. Their animals are fine. The art is fine. And what a great story. Lily and I get to ask Lee and Carla to share while performing, presiding over our wedding.
Oh, they didn't tell the story?
Because who better to talk about the importance as partners of sitting in the fire together than people who have literally done that,
fire.
Right?
Fantastic.
Quite an honor to have them participate in that way. And finally, is there anything better than the Scandinavian country, I think it's Finland,
yes,
that our president, POTUS45, singled out for the wonderful way they rake their forests to prevent similar fires and catastrophe. Is there anything better than the internet memes created by that Finlandian fire prevention force?
Forest thing. To be fair, Finland does have a flora fauna removal system. However, does that
Look,
prevent
I mean,
the fire? Whatever.
You know, a Finn posting, you know, a selfie with a rake. Hashtag ready to do my part is like so great. Hey, by the way, so we love that.
We love that.
I mean, nothing but destruction with an occasional touching story, obviously, to come out of these tragedies that are going to become more
epic.
Plentiful
yeah.
and more destructive as the years go on, unless we completely change the way that we live in relationship to nature. But again, at least a little bit of humor coming out of it. And at the same time, I learn about something called slow TV that comes out of Norway. And it, somehow I missed all this, but it's very popular at parties here to just put on these videos from Norway that are like 8 hours of a train's perspective.
Oh, yeah.
Driving through the snow.
Through the snow and then tunnels and everything.
Or as what aired, I guess, recently this fall on Norwegian TV, setting ratings records as it would... 8 hours of log chopping and log burning. But it apparently, this 8-hour primetime broadcast divided the nation of Norway, with fully half the audience very upset, I guess because the logs were turned face down while burning, and the other half being very pleased that they weren't face up. Well, so it was the
because
up,
you
want to
burn the bark first. With the sap off.
But everybody's got their own way to do it.
Yeah, I know.
And
it was
there was a major New York Times article about how this divided. Thank God we haven't gotten quite that divided in this country.
For those of you who are on your Roku box, I recommend Stargazer channel, which is seemingly a feed from the International Space Station pointing down at Earth with plinky piano music going on in real time. So it is just going over a clouded planet Earth with no narrative, no nothing, and just a...
It kind of sounds like Andrei Tarkovsky's Solaris, which is one of my favorite.
You know what? There's many similarities. Slowly the clouds move by. It's called Stargazer channel. Download it on your Roku streaming and turn it on. And just enjoy dinner and a glass of wine watching that.
Now, we have a live event of the week.
Oh,
so
let's hear that.
I guess.
The Chilpack Hollywood live event of the week.
I turned 50, Dean
Hagler. Oh, my God. Happy birthday.
And ever since I was in my mid-40s, I somehow knew
you were going to turn 50.
That I was going to... I had a sneaking suspicion, that
that day was encroaching.
That's where everything was heading. There were a few times when I thought I had somehow gotten out of it.
No. You recreated 1949.
So I always knew that I was going to celebrate. I don't know. I didn't know how. I hadn't even discovered the Breakfast Club, but I always knew since about the time I was 45 that I would turn 50 on stage.
Wow.
I always had envisioned some sort of stage show. And as you know, a couple years ago, I hosted a fundraiser for the Breakfast Club that also served as a tribute to the days of yore, when the Breakfast Club was the longest running radio program anywhere in the world. And
Jimmy Durante sang.
And that was such a success that we had an encore performance of that. And then the next year, Lily said, hey, will you put on another one so we can raise some more money? And I said, no, because
as you do,
quite frankly, I was exhausted. And also I needed the right theme to it, because it's a lot of work to just try to, I don't know why, but to write like a show, even a variety show, you know how you once said, like with the improv show, if you thought for a minute that you had to write that show,
you couldn't do it.
It would be exhausting.
Yeah.
And instead, you know,
you come up
with a theme. You come up with a theme for your
line.
Improv show.
Yeah, right.
And then so that's what I needed, was the through line, because that would allow me to create the skeleton in a very fun way.
Yeah, right? That you hang all the variety acts on.
So here were a couple of the possibilities.
Oh, let's hear them.
One was, at one point, the last vaudeville show.
Oh, yes.
That could be fun.
That was a thing.
Again, Breakfast Club starts in 1925.
Right.
So why not?
End of vaudeville.
The other thing was, could it be a recreation of an actual event that took place at the Breakfast Club? Something called Leif Erikson Day 1952.
Shut up.
Don't kid yourself.
What?
That might have to happen. But when I saw the available dates, then I knew what it had to be, because I indeed actually turned 50 while on stage. So what better way to celebrate than with a show set during the final hour of 1949? It was a New Year's Eve show. And once I did my introduction off the stage, explaining it to anyone who didn't know.
Right.
And then through, after yelling Happy New Year, then a cake was brought out and people sang Happy Birthday to me. Right. So at that point, the theme was over. But everything between those things was period authentic.
Wow.
We didn't even have wireless mics. The only thing was that I did play one music cue off an iPod.
Oh.
That was pre-recorded. That was the only way to do it. But all the jokes were... period authentic. They were written. Jack Benny, Bob Hope.
You stole all their jokes?
I crafted this whole thing. In fact, the biggest challenge of crafting it was not making it seem too much like a commentary on what's going on now.
Right.
Because so much of the jokes in 1949 was about how suddenly we'd found ourselves in something called a Cold War, and it's all these Russian jokes.
Yeah, right.
And like jokes about how thank God we have a Republican Congress keeping us safe from the Russians. You know, and I was like, okay, I gotta cut that out because that seems like I'm just commenting.
Right,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But like really funny jokes like, you know, what the differences between our countries. Like, you know, it takes 10 years to buy a car. This is 1949.
Yeah.
There, it takes 10 years to buy a car. Here, the traffic's so bad that in order to make it to the broadcast on time tonight, I had to park at home. you know, so that's an actual joke.
And
then they explain how, you know, there, the guy goes into the dealer, buys a car. The dealer tells him, all right, it'll be delivered to your house in 10 years. And the guy says, morning or afternoon. And the dealer goes, what does it matter? And the buyer says, well, because I have the plumber coming in the morning. That's like funny stuff.
That's
right?
Funny stuff.
It really is good.
Oh my God, that's always Yakov Smirnoff funny.
But I think that was Jack Benny. But anyway, but so it was all this period authentic stuff. Lily played Betty Davis, who people hadn't seen much of in the previous couple years, but was about to make a big comeback with a movie called All About Eve. So she was there promoting All About Eve. And it was great because Lily comes out on stage and after doing a little ad lib with Dawn, our piano player, saying, was that the theme to Now Voyager? And Dawn said, yes, it was. And Lily goes, good for you. And then back to the audience and says, you know, buckle your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night, right?
Fantastic.
And, well, yeah, but that's what the reaction everybody had.
Right.
And then, so then Lily scolded them saying, how do you know that line? The movie hasn't come out yet.
It was really good.
It was really good. So like when I came out, I pull an old Bob Hope line during the opening monologue. I say, you know, Happy New Year, everybody. I'm Phil Balldrop Lairness, a nickname I was given when I played college football. And then, exactly. And so then I said, and if you thought there was another connotation towards that, you're forgetting that this is a family show and that it's 1949. That wasn't a thing.
That's right. That's hilarious. So, where can people see this show? Did it get recorded?
They can't. It got recorded. And
Will it be up on a podcasty thing?
I'll play some excerpts on the Breakfast Club podcast that I'm going to drop between Christmas and New Year's. We're not doing one at the end of this month. I've started to slow down on that podcast a little bit.
Just too much. It's too much.
Just a little too much.
I hear
a little
that.
Too much.
You're 50 now. You gotta enjoy the sunsets.
And you get, you know, you want to work better, not necessarily harder.
Don't we all?
Does that make sense?
I don't know.
All right.
Yeah.
Boy, we're just sprinting through this show, aren't we?
It's almost over. We should do another one.
Well, maybe we will, but let's. we've got some real august personages from the world of entertainment to say farewell to.
Yes.
So, what do you say we open up the Chill Pack morgue?
Yes.
Brought to you by the Chill Pack, which itself is dead.
It's true. Mine still works. They were, you know, planned without any obsolescence, and so
keeping. Dead bodies cold, and laptop computers running fast.
Since 2004.
Celebrity deaths.
We lost a true...
Thank you, Garrett Watley.
...giant of international cinema.
Oh.
And I don't mean we lost... Why did I say lost? He died.
He died.
We're not going to find him. Right. I hope not. Anyway,
what?
Bernardo Bertolucci, 77 years old. Right. And again, in the wake of Me Too and Time's Up, the bloom's off this particular rose a little bit, one must say.
Hard to watch Last Tango in Paris now.
And not just I think both because of the text and the context of how it was made. But both those things. Yes,
both those things. The stories that are come out of how, what the actor suffered in performing it, and also
at the hands of Brando and the director.
Yeah, that idea.
Here's the surprising thing to me. So Bertolucci, Oscar-winning filmmaker, really establishes a huge international reputation with what might be really his masterpiece, which was The Conformist.
Oh, yeah, right.
It's a great, great movie.
Right.
And and I'm stunned to realize he makes that at 29 years of age.
Wow.
Yeah, that's up there with, like, Welles 25 making Citizen Kane.
Yeah, for sure.
And The Conformist seems to be such a wise movie with a real understanding of generational political movements.
Yeah.
Right? Like a long view of history for someone so young to have captured and mastered. Anyway, I saw the film multiple times, but the most recent time was what must have been its 25th or 30th anniversary, somewhere in there, at the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, a big restoration of it. It's shown on the big screen as part of a tribute to the maestro himself, to Bertolucci, who I get to meet that night because I am the guest of a director who had made quite a mark in the 1960s and then, for a variety of reasons, fell on hard times, but knew Bertolucci. And what was so cool was he said, "Do you want to meet Bertolucci?" And I said, "Sure." And he said, "Okay, I'll introduce you." And what was so nice and just really touching was how genuinely thrilled Bertolucci seemed to see this old man that I was with.
Really?
Yeah, and called him maestro.
What?
Yeah, and said to me, "You learn everything you can from this man."
Who is this man?
Hubert Cornfield, filmmaker. And anyway, and I never forgot that. I mean, just how genuinely, at the very least, it was a completely convincing performance. You don't know.
But, you don't know, right?
But if you're completely convinced, does it matter?
Does it matter?
Right? And I'm sure it made him feel good. And but quite honestly, it might have been. I mean, this after all, is a director who had worked with Brando before Bertolucci does.
Yeah, right.
And who is an influence on the new wave in Europe. So anyway, that's one of my two Bertolucci brushes with greatness.
I want to hear the other.
The other is, I mentioned my friend Peter Murnik earlier in this show.
Yeah.
And he and I used to house sit for the estate of Nando Scarfiotti.
Nando Scarfiotti.
Oscar-winning production designer who had designed his own house in the Hollywood Hills up on Miller Drive.
Wow.
And after he died of AIDS, the estate, well, I guess, who knows what the machinations were in terms of what was going to happen to the estate or the house or whatever. I never got to know anything about that. Right. But they would have a few of us house sit the place.
Right.
And I, at that time, was a much sought after house sitter. I had quite a good reputation as a house sitter. And
how did you get that reputation?
Here's how. I mean, I don't know how people know about this, but here's how. One of the ways is by house sitting this man's beautiful house, and you never sleep in the master bedroom. Not because you weren't told, but because it just didn't feel appropriate to
you. It's weird.
You take the smallest bedroom you possibly can, and you make the least mess you can, even though no one's ever going to be in there. No one is going to know about it, but you're going to know about it. And I feel like if that's the impulse you have, you're a good house sitter.
As opposed to trashing the place.
He had a gigantic cat that used to huge bed, but this gigantic cat that would just stayed all day and night, like standing vigil the center of that bedroom, and I'm a cat person.
I know.
And this cat didn't seem to ever warm up to me too much, but again, I just kept distance and everything, and until one day I just came back and the cat had gone hunting for me. Is now trying to
kill you.
No, befriend us.
Oh,
cats will bring you their kill to show you how much they love you.
He brought you a kill,
and in fact, gave me things so fresh they were still alive, and was giving me the honor to finish them off.
If you could snap the neck of this rat, that'd
but,
be great.
But Bertolucci.
Oh, right, back to Bertolucci. Yes.
Matt Labatique, my cinematographer at the time, now an Oscar-nominated cinematographer, he and I would go through the library that Scarfiotti had.
Yeah.
And we opened one volume, and it was great because it was a gift to him from Bertolucci. Scarfiotti, among other things, had designed The Last Emperor, which was Bertolucci's Oscar-winning film.
Right.
And anyway, the inscription was from Bertolucci, and again, it said, Dear Maestro, to his production designer, and then on there, and that just we loved it, you know. Touching
he called
that
everybody
book with,
maestro.
Anybody you respected,
right? Yeah.
And if you weren't a maestro, maybe he didn't respect.
Maybe that's your problem.
You don't know.
No, that's right.
So, were you a Bertolucci fan?
Well, you know, I took Italian cinema in my one of my electives back in university days, and so I was up in my Bertolucci and my. Things. Was I a Bertolucci fan, though? I mean, coming from the lineage of the Verte school, I thought he really was embracing Hollywood mores more than Italian.
Yeah.
The lineage that he was come from. He was really influenced by his time, I thought.
Isn't that why The Conformist, though, is so powerful?
Right.
Because it marries these really resonant themes of how people will conform to fascist lifestyles and the reasons why. You know, something that at that time seemed foreign to us.
Right.
And maybe turns out to be prescient, but brings to it a kind of a Hollywood lavishness.
Lavishness and a technique. Aesthetic.
But that combination was great.
Yes, there. But then I think every movie thereafter, he stepped farther and farther towards a Hollywood
more
70s
and more
aesthetic.
Hollywood. And further and further away from the stories that he had to tell.
Exactly. And to my mind, so it sort of seemed not a sad downward spiral, per se, but an embracing of perhaps, like we say about Johnny Depp, you know, where the studio execs go, yeah, oh my God, we love when you did that, do more of that. And then he's listening to that and getting farther away from an artistic impulse.
Well, you also think about Last Emperor.
Yeah.
So he becomes everything that he'd wanted to be.
Right.
And The Last Emperor is not one of his best movies, but he becomes everything he wants to be.
Right.
And be careful what you wish for, because you might get it. Then what does he do?
Right.
And
that's exactly the story.
He seemed very much like an afterthought since then.
Yeah.
He had some big movies. He had Sheltering Sky, but his whole impetus was to become the Hollywood royalty.
Yeah, and he did that.
And then what do you do? Yeah.
Yeah. So it seemed so far away, and yet it was so accessible.
It was. Yeah. How about Ricky Jay, Dean Haglund?
Ricky Jay, I retweeted his or Frank Spotnitz's lovely memorial. Ricky Jay
dies at 72.
Yeah,
magician.
Yeah.
And popular character actor. Which do you want to take? You want to
well,
talk about
you know
him
what?
As a magician?
Or? Well, let's say a magician, because was he a magician or was he a card mechanic? I'm not, you know me in magic. I'm not a big fan of the David Copperfields and the showy tuxedo ruffled fellers. That's not my kind of show.
By the way, there's a kid. I say kid. He's 27 now.
Yeah.
But he's I've gotten to watch him grow up at the Breakfast Club. Basically,
yeah.
Early 20s when he joins the Breakfast Club. Brave, seriously, one of the most courageous men I know. I call him up. He's an illustrator.
Uh-huh.
I call him up, and I said, because I needed a magic act, and our magic act dropped out, and it was just really hell. They all kept making themselves disappear. but so I called him up, and I said, I need you to perform in this say yes, and then I'll tell you what you're doing. And so he said yes, and I said, okay, you're going to be doing magic. And he said, okay. I said, have you ever done it? He said, no. Do you know any? No. So will you learn? Yes.
Yes.
And so he did a mind reading act, and it was great.
Oh, see? Yeah. Yeah.
And people said, boy, Phil, you really sold it. I mean, because you seemed so nervous, like, oh, it might not work. It might not. And I said, you know why I seem nervous? Because in rehearsal, every trick fails. Anyway.
Oh, that's great. So, yeah, Ricky Jay as a magician. Was more a card mechanic, I thought. He did a Broadway show called My 52 Friends.
I know.
Yeah, and that
so
he could,
good.
He could throw a card from stage into the upper balconies with precision, hitting seats. He could throw cards into the skin of a watermelon and embed it. And the story I had heard was he was at a party after the 52 Friends, and he's showing, you know, show close hand magic tricks.
Right.
And somebody's going, ah, come on, these are all bullshit. Let's see a real trick. You know, guy's drunk. And Ricky Jay, not suffering fools gladly, does a trick where he takes all of the deck of cards and sprays them in the guy's face, just squeezes them all. All 52 cards go squeezing. Just before he said, name a card. And the guy, you know, whatever he says, three of clubs, sprays him in his face, and then goes, fuck you, leaves, and then in the wine bottle on the coffee table, rolled up, stuffed down the neck of the bottle, is the three of clubs. And it's like, and Ricky Jay went nowhere near the coffee table, just sprayed the cards in the guy's face, and somehow managed to roll the card and get it in the wine bottle, all in one thing, in a gesture of complete disdain. And I think it's that energy, that disdain, not just towards the audience, but towards the ruffled tuxedoed magician aesthetic is what I appreciated most about that guy.
It is what also made him a great
character actor.
I mean, yep. That combination of being grounded in such a specific authenticity,
yeah,
while trading in illusion.
Yeah, right?
Authenticity and illusion?
Well,
what a combination. And therefore, he becomes, among other people, a favorite of someone like David Mamet.
Yeah.
Whose pictures, whose movies especially, and even, you know, his plays are often about a swindle, a con.
Yeah.
And yet rooted in the authenticity of that particular milieu, whatever it is.
And this is often the thing. Magic and a con and a swindle all have to be grounded in some fact or it doesn't work. And to my mind, Ricky Jay had based so much about his shows, his act, in something very genuine, something very personal, and something, as you know, in acting, that has to come from yourself, right?
So he appears in the following movies for David Mamet.
Right.
House of Games.
Yep.
Such a great movie.
Yeah.
State in Maine, which is about filmmaking, The Spanish Prisoner, and Red Belt.
Right.
Filmmaking is a sleight of hand con, right? That's literally what it is, right? How do we make you believe you're seeing what you think you are seeing? And how are we not allowing you to see what it is possible for you to see that would destroy the illusion?
Right.
And I think it's therefore apropos that he, the first movie that really launches him into notable character actor status is Boogie Nights.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Oh, right. I forgot about that.
He plays a filmmaker in that.
Yeah, right.
With another X-Files guest star, Burt Reynolds.
Right?
Ricky Jay guest stars in a great, great, which is why Frank Spotnitz tweeted about it, great X-Files episode, the Amazing Malini.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
A seventh season episode that's really one of the best of that year.
Kind of really good. And I remember seeing Ricky Jay at the production office, but just saying, hey, really like your work. He said, thank you. And that was the end of our exchange. So to say I know him is a misnomer.
So far, the end of your exchange so far. But his greatest trick.
Oh, right. Is making you believe that he wasn't there.
Yeah, maybe you'll see him again. Some other credits. The Prestige. How awesome. Oh, yeah. that he's in that movie about magic. Mm-hmm. Another movie I think that's kind of underrated, underappreciated. And David Mamet's, wasn't Heist a David Mamet film also?
Yeah, that's Heist, yeah.
I thought so as well. Born Richard J. Potash in Brooklyn, New York. He began his magic career in New York City, opening for musical acts like Ike and Tina Turner.
Yeah.
Well, you have to be kind of badass if you're going to be opening for those. You're not opening again in Vegas for the ruffled shirt set, right?
Right.
They're not going to...
Ruffled tuxedos.
They're not going to have a lot of patience for you. He also played card shark Eddie Sawyer on the HBO Western series Deadwood. And there was something really oddly right about a Ricky Jay in the frontiers of the Old West.
Yeah, that same authenticity and that grisly, you know, his voice, he seemed to sit on his voice a lot. You know, there wasn't a lot of expressive range because he taught, you know, it's always kind of felt low. And because it, to me, it was not about the expression of the actor, but the expressiveness of the trick itself. It was the card trick that took center stage.
So that brings us to an end of an hour. What do you say we stop here and then, I don't know, we'll pre-record some stuff for next week.
You're blowing the whole
edit. I can edit. No. I mean, I've been editing.
To hell with it. This is the end of this show.
Okay, you can find every episode of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour at chillpackhollywood.com. C-H-I-L-L-P-A-K, Hollywood.com. Yep. Download them, stream them, subscribe via iTunes.
Even write a review, and you can email us. We're at chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com, and you can follow us on Twitter and Instagram with the very same handle. We're at Dean and Phil. Spell out the word and.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, and what's our hashtag?
We give good hashtag.
That's right.
All right, until next week, I'm Phil Lernis.
I'm Dean Haglund.
Guests of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour stay at the Baldwin Hills Motor Inn.
In a historic building in downtown Los Angeles.
Promotional consideration paid for by Empire State Gas. From farm to pump, we've got great gas. Belated spoiler alert.